Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. We all have an instinct, a homing signal, and even when we try to ignore it, it drives us back to the place where everything got started. That's a Snap story, stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. Find it on iTunes under Podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, the return of a film franchise of which you might have thought you'd seen the last gets us talking about whether it's ever too late to resuscitate, revive, or just plain reanimate your favorite property. Then we will dip our right toe and then our left toe into the shark-infested waters of pop culture dichotomies. Kirk or Spock, Beatles or Stones, you get the idea. We'll talk about camps we're in, camps we're over, and why there are so many camps in the first place. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week in the studio is Petra Mayer. Petra Mayer, what do you do at NPR?
I'm an editor at NPR Books.
Well, it's always wonderful to have you with us, Petra. Uh-huh.
Yay.
And what brings us here this week is not, I want to make clear, Dumb and Dumber 2. But part of what brought us to our initial topic was saying to ourselves, we're not going to see Dumb and Dumber 2.
It is a wobbly peg on which we may hang to this week's topic.
But if we were, what might we say about it? And one of our thoughts was, is it ever too late to come back? Because that franchise, you had Dumb and Dumber in 1994. You had the prequel, Dumb and Dumberer, in 2003.
Oh, the prequel with different actors.
With different actors.
Yeah.
And now, in 2014, the original actors, Jeff Daniels and Jim Carrey, are back for Dumb and Dumber 2. That's T-O. I don't know. I'm not going to it, but this creates a 20-year gap from the first one to really the second one with these guys in it. The middle one, that one is kind of like when the two guys replaced Bo and Luke Duke during the contract.
Coy and Vance, I'm pretty sure.
That's right. Coy and Vance.
Oh, Petra. I'm so glad you're here.
So there's a 20-year gap between the first real movie and the second real movie in this franchise. And, boy, we've defined authenticity down, haven't we? And one of the reasons why Petra is with us this week, certainly not the only reason, we've got many, but one of them is that we thought that we could ask her, among other things, about the long gap that happened in Doctor Who, where it went away in, what, 89, and then it didn't come back until 2005.
Well, some values of didn't. The thing about Doctor Who is that there was always a huge fan community, and there were novels, and there were radio plays, and some people decided that they were going to do radio plays about a very similar character, and he's very, very similar adventures that were... They didn't have the copyright, but it was basically the same thing.
I've done the same thing with my Dumb and Dumber fan fiction.
So what you're saying is that Doctor Who, the TV show, stopped, but the property kind of continued to be evolving and to be happening the entire time.
And not only that, it was licensed to various publishers for a series of novels. And in 1996, there was a spectacularly ill-considered attempt to bring it back as a TV show via a TV movie co-produced. Glenn is looking at me knowingly. I've watched this.
Of course.
Know
you
that
have.
I have done this for
as,
you, Glenn.
As have I. I've seen it, too.
TV show co-produced between...
You're aware of its work.
Between the BBC and Fox. which was aired opposite the Super Bowl, which was not the reason it tanked. It tanked because it was terrible.
Yeah.
So the hiatus, it wasn't really a hiatus.
It's a little different. It's a modified hiatus.
This gets to the point. Who was clamoring? That's the question to ask. Whenever there's a hiatus like this, how late is too late determines who was clamoring. Now, I talked to my brother and his son, my 21-year-old nephew, this weekend about Dumb and Dumber and this movie. They're not going to go see it, but this sentence came out of my nephew's mouth. Oh, Dumb and Dumber, that's a classic. Now, I had two thoughts. First was, I need to find an ice floe and a fistful of barbiturates and just sail out because my time is done. That was my first thought. Second thought was, boy, you know what's pliable? The English language. Classic. We have instant nostalgia now. Yeah. We have nostalgia for things that happened last week.
But okay, but he's 20,
a young man.
But he's 21.
Exactly right.
So to him, this has been around his whole life.
When something like that happens, when Dumb and Dumber comes back and you hear a lot of really, is because it was never a niche product. It was a mainstream product. Niche products become cults.
Right.
Mainstream products that are huge among everybody tend not to. They become franchises. It's different.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what would be a...
The comeback on HBO was not a huge mainstream success, but it developed a cult following. When it came back, you didn't hear, really, that? You heard, awesome.
Well, you heard either, I've never heard of it.
That's exactly the point.
Or... I'm incredibly excited to see it come back.
Twin Peaks starts out as a huge mainstream success, becomes a niche product over the course of a year and a half. When it comes back, there's a lot of, Star Trek, the original series, again, was a small success, was kept on the air by a fervent fan base. It goes away. It becomes this cult, becomes this thing that drives conventions. And then it comes in back as a mainstream product, as a huge motion picture, which doesn't do very well, and it's not very good. But it takes a while for it to kind of find its equilibrium and then becomes a franchise. The Doctor Who, I think, is an example of this, again, because it was fed by all of these conventions, all of these other products. Evil Dead, we just learned earlier this week, the Evil Dead series of films is becoming a limited television show starring Bruce Campbell, Ash versus the Evil Dead, directed by Sam Raimi. And again, it became a big success with Army of Darkness, the third film in that franchise, but it still retained its cult sensibility. That's why people don't think, this is too late.
Yeah.
So for you, it has to be a cult item, and that's why Dumb and Dumber doesn't fall.
There's others that don't fall into this that are still coming back, but I think what I'm talking about is that feeling of...
Of ownership.
People who
feel they own it are excited. I mean, this is one of the things that I wanted to bring up was the idea of fan service.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about fan service on this show before, but when you are bringing back a long dormant property, there's this sense, I think, with a lot of what you're bringing back that you just have to shovel lots of inside jokes at people.
Veronica Mars
being an example, Arrested Development being an example. Yeah. I think Anchorman falls into this category. There was a very long gap between Anchorman and Anchorman 2 to the point where I think Anchorman 2 felt like a gigantic mainstream property and then performed kind of like a cult movie that didn't do that well.
I was just going to make a small point about, especially with Star Trek, syndication, I think, has a lot to do with it, because Star Trek simmered along in the popular consciousness because it lasted long enough to go into syndication. You know, in the 90s, there was that whole spate of 60s TV movie remakes, like, you know, Car 54. All that stuff. And I think a lot of that had to do with syndication keeping these things in the popular eye. In the case of Doctor Who, it was a lot of it also was because it had been running for so long that the people that loved the show as kids were grown up and then in a position of power to bring it back.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but that's, okay, that's, in the U.S., Doctor Who was a niche product because it aired in the 70s and 80s, at least, you know, Friday night at 11 o'clock. You're going to find a very specific audience there. In the U.K., of course, it's wallpaper. It's in the air. It's basically background
noise. It's the universal social solvent.
Exactly. Fargo had a cult sensibility, that film, but it was a mainstream success.
Well, and the return of Fargo, quote unquote, is not really a return. The return of Fargo is really... I mean, in a lot of ways, that was just the brand coming back.
Yeah, well, the idea.
That was the idea of it and the tone of it, but it was not, that was not a, let's go back to this world to see what happened to these people, the way that the comeback was, the way that Anchorman was. That was not a return to the same universe. I mean, it is the same universe, but
it wasn't greeted with, okay, it was greeted with, really?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Why would you do that is the question that doesn't necessarily get asked if you got this fervent cult. Fervency is a metric.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go back for a minute to something that Stephen brought up, which is Arrested Development. Because the interesting thing about Arrested Development is, time-wise, that wasn't that long.
Right.
That wasn't an undoable gap.
Was it 6 or 8 years?
And yet, I felt like when that came back, it just felt like the moment had dissipated. I don't know whether other people felt that way, but I mean, there was some sense that because of the way they had to shoot it with everybody kind of not together and they weren't able to get the same chemistry. But for me, it was partly just certain things do have this moment that they create. If you try to go back, it's not necessarily a matter of how long it's been. It's just that you can't get the energy to kind of come back into it. Whereas with other things, I would argue on the comeback, that energy kind of returns pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That energy is there. again, much more than I felt like it was when I went back and watched the fourth season of Arrested Development.
Yeah, I think Arrested Development imposed some disadvantages on itself.
Right.
I think the fact that some of those episodes are like 37 minutes long and feel just, and the energy is just all thrown off. I think in music you have just as many interesting examples of this, that Guns N' Roses took 17 years to release its album Chinese Democracy, during which time it's kind of like Dr. Dre's Detox, where like they just basically can't make this record at this point. It's been too long. And when Chinese Democracy came out, it landed with a bit of a plop. First of all, it's, I mean, the energy is completely different. I mean, Axl Rose is 17 years older, but at the same time, what in a band or any sort of, I just keep saying cultural property, you know, whether it's a TV show or a movie franchise or a band, what is really lost by coming back and having it not work? Is it tarnishing a legacy?
Star Wars.
Okay, there's that. I mean, I almost think it's never too late to come back if you are passionate about something and you have a good PR team. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, that the question is, what's tarnished? It's your bank account, really. I mean, the question of when's too late to come back is, to me, it's an economic question. It's,
do people still care?
How dead does something have to be before you can run some lightning through it and into your bank account? And the answer is, it can be any old dead thing if you have a sense of humor and you're passionate.
Any old dead thing, Vetramaire.
And you have a good PR team.
Yeah.
You know, it's art, here we go with the cheese ball Hallmark card profundity. But, I mean, art doesn't have to have an audience. Look at Henry Darger.
No, that's true. And the downside, I will say, and, you know, Glenn mentioned Star Wars. The thing about Star Wars for me, the sad thing about that, is that I do regret, in a way, the inability to leave things alone.
Yeah,
I do feel like it's not a matter of, like, now your legacy is tarnished. It's just now I have to ignore part of what you're telling me your thing is. Like, now I have to say, I just treat that like it didn't happen. And you can do that.
Yep.
And I recognize that Star Wars is a bad example of that in the sense that he originally had this plan for these 9 movies. And yet, after the first 3 had come out, there is part of me that feels like, well, this was very beloved. And despite the fact that they were, you know, there are people who are anti-Ewok and everything. For whatever reason.
Hello, my name is Glenn.
There was an anti-Ewok lobby. But even though that movie certainly wasn't perfect, there still were a lot of charming things about it. And there were things that people loved about it. And
it's better for not being perfect.
And I still feel like I would have preferred to sort of, okay, let that be a thing. Say, here's my trilogy. Anything beyond a trilogy, I start to wonder, kind of, why are we still doing this?
Right. Well, anytime that there's a fervency, anytime there's this kind of cult feeling, part of it, and I don't know how much, but part of it is about a sense that something's unfinished, that we haven't gotten everything we need to get from this thing. And, you know, Petra's coming at this from saying, you know, it's never too late, because I think, Petra, you're a deep relationship with fan fiction and a bunch of other ancillary products, I think, means that you understand that the universe is wider than what the auteur is telling us, that there's this other equally valid world around it. You know, for example, Toy Story 4, I dread that because I think it told its little story. Right. I don't have this feeling of unfinishedness.
They completed a trilogy with that movie.
Speaking of Spider-Man. Now, is anything too late? Oh, there's such a thing as too soon. And Spider-Man is too soon. The Amazing Spider-Man.
You're talking about to reboot.
To go back and actually, now, it doesn't feel like a James Bond property where we're just getting story after story after story, and we do every so often get a sort of weird pseudo re-origin story.
Yeah.
We just get, okay, we've told this story, and now let's start it again.
Yeah, and Petra is over here gesturing wildly, and
please.
I think feels some agreement with your position.
Get out of my head. Or is it your day to have the brain?
Yeah.
First of all, to address your first point, it's partially because I've never given up hope that Firefly will come back. Speaking of feeling unfinished.
This is what I mean.
I actually literally, I'm looking at my notes, and my notes say, I don't think you can ever say too late about art, but you can say how soon is too soon, and I have in caps, Spider-Man, I'm looking at you.
Exactly.
There was a great article, actually, in The Onion. It was about the U.S. Department of Retro warns that we're running out of retro.
We actually mentioned it on the show a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I just, anything can be, bring back the parallel Perils of Pauline, but I don't, I don't really want to see another BuzzFeed listicle about the Delius catalog. You know, that's too soon.
I do. I mean, I also wanted to bring up the notion of pieces of culture where they are complete and a lot of the people involved with them have moved on or died, and then you get an attempt to write a sequel to Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
Or, you know, create a sequel to The Wizard of Oz, you know, decades later. How do we feel about that? Because those are often often treated as defiling.
But that's fan fiction. I mean, that's now you're back into this world of, do you have the right to create your own parallel?
Right.
I mean, the copy, you know, you get into, like, I think in terms of copyright words, like derivative works and stuff like that. But what is your entitlement to take this thing and sort of run with it? And I think people feel legitimately different ways about that. And artists feel legitimately different ways about that. There are people who say, I don't want people to go off and write their own sequel to my book. There are people who find that really weird and uncomfortable and unsettling. And I can certainly imagine situations where particular choices people would make, like, I've decided to write a thing with characters that you created where I say they did these things.
No, instead they got married.
I can imagine that being really...
Casablanca 2.
I can imagine that being really unsettling. Or I can imagine people not caring. You know what I mean? Like, I think it just depends on how you want to approach it. And I think it depends on what you think the creator owns and doesn't own.
I do think there has to be a word for the kind of dread that fans feel when their property is about to be brought back. And the feeling that I had as somebody who
nostalgia.
Nostalgia. Exactly.
Very perfect.
God, Holmesy, this is one of many reasons I keep you around. But that feeling that Glenn and I had, I remember when Arrested Development was coming back, that I had when Pee Wee Herman said there was going to be another Pee Wee Herman movie. Like, boy, I saw a Big Top Pee Wee. I'm not sure that you've got it in yet.
You want to be excited, but you're like,
But there's also a feeling at the same time that's like, well, this is free.
Exactly.
And I can take it or leave it. Yeah. I can accept it in the canon or reject it. And is it really any skin off my rear end if it's not good?
Well, let me ask you, Petra. Was there sort of nostalgia when they were bringing it back in 2005? Or by then, did people just figure, well, we'll see what it is?
I hate to admit this, but in 2005, I was not a Doctor Who fan.
Oh, I see. So you don't know.
No, well, there was some trepidation about it because people remembered the terrible TV movie. And then there had been an attempt maybe in 2003, I think, to revive it as a web series with Richard E. Grant as the Doctor. He's the non-canonical Ninth Doctor. And it did not go particularly well, although interestingly, David Tennant had a bit part in it. As far as I can tell, because I did read obsessively about everything related to Doctor Who once I got into it, there was some trepidation, but people seem to think that Russell T. Davis is probably a good guy to do it.
Yeah. I can verify that. I was one of those people who was waiting for it to come back and was very excited that it was Russell T. Davies from Queer as Folk. I thought that would be awesome. My dread was, I hope they don't make it look too good. I hope they don't spend too much money and make it look too slick.
Because and your wish came true.
And my wish came very, very true. It's called charm, people, and that's what the show has in spades.
I think what we're coming around to here is it is not per se too late to come back, but there are perils to coming back after a long absence. It can be a fraught thing to do.
I hate to bring everything back to Doctor Who because, as you guys will have established, that's the only thing I can talk about. But the fact that it has gone on for so long and it has been so varied teaches fans of the show to sort of the weather. It will change in 10 minutes.
That's
with it.
Right.
There are parts you like and parts you hate, and you know overall that you love the parts you love, and something good will come around.
Yeah, well, that is a happy aspect of anything with an element of anthology.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think one of the things that has made Doctor Who so durable is that it has that element of anthology. In the same way that, like, shows like American Horror Story, it's like, if you're not into this one, you might be into the next one.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think people are already in that place with American Horror Story. I already have talked to people who are like, well, I wasn't into Coven, but I'm super into Freak Show. Like, because it refreshes itself in a very specific, pre-planned, deliberate, predictable way, as opposed to shows where you have to sort of think, well, I really wish they would drop this story and get on to another story. Like, there's a secret sibling who showed up one time on Dawson's Creek and then just was gone. Like, they just were about to reveal, like, she's her sister. Never mind. Because no one cared. So they just dropped it, like, bye.
Well, that's it. The secret to a lot of this is, how do we keep our prices so low? Volume, volume, volume. You just churn it out. That's why an individual Bond film doesn't have these huge stakes the way that a Star Wars film does. Yeah. Or a Trek film. Like, a Trek film comes out, there's been enough of them that some of them were good, some of them were bad. It's just, as Petra was saying, we roll with it.
Yep. And I think we would be very interested to hear what folks have to say about this. I suspect this may be a thing where people have some opinions.
Yeah, I bet.
So find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Okay, we got to take a little break. And when we come back, we will be talking about pop culture dichotomies. Think about whether you are Beatles or a Stones person. Think about whether you are Kirk or a Spock person. And when we get back, we will get into all of this in much greater detail. So hang around.
If you're a fan of this podcast, know it's made possible in part by Match.com, number one in dates, relationships, and marriages. Match.com has redefined the way that you can connect with people you want to meet, both online and offline. With nationwide events and the ability to search and communicate with other members, every year, hundreds of thousands of people find love on Match. Match is offering the opportunity to try out Match for 7 days, completely free. Go to trymatch.com to get started with your 7 days free today.
Welcome back. Our other topic today is pop culture dichotomies. Now, we're going to try to do this without any knockdown dragouts. We're not looking for fights. We're talking about these dichotomies. We're not necessarily trying to hash any of them out because I'm not 100% positive we can solve some of these things here in the room. Glenn, do you want to kick us off? Do you have anything to say about this? Do you have any insight?
Well, if you prefer Darren Stevens 1 or Darren Stevens 2, it says something very important about you.
All right, remind me who these people are.
Samantha Stevens' husband on Bewitched. It was either Dick York or Dick Sargent. Dick York was a jerk and always yelled and had a really annoying voice. Dick Sargent was a nicer guy.
Oh.
Dick Sargent all the way.
I see.
Mm. But hey, Dick York had a background in mental hygiene films, which makes him awesome.
No, that's true. He does turn up in mental hygiene films. Trek versus Wars, everybody. Let's start there.
Well, I personally am Wars because I have not watched very much Trek.
Right.
And because Wars is much more a part of my childhood, and that's where my nostalgia attached.
Mm-hmm.
So I have really mostly that. But I'm going to posit, aren't there an awful lot of both Trek and Wars people?
Yeah.
I mean, people who like both.
This whole exercise is just a simply reductionist thing. You're trying to make everybody be binary, and nobody's
right.
binary.
Exactly.
There's a whole world. And so these are meant just to generate discussion. That's all
true.
This is about.
Well, I think there's a little more to it than that, though. I think there is something about the way we choose to identify ourselves. We're very often making a statement about ourselves that is not about a preference of one piece of culture over another. I was surprised when I was looking at some of these examples, how often they boil down to, do you like the dirty thing or the clean thing?
For example?
Beatles and Stones.
Mm-hmm.
Britney Spears,
Christina Aguilera.
Talk about which of those you consider to be the dirty thing or the clean thing.
Well, and clean, I'm being very loose in my terminology
right.
with both. But Beatles is very polished, very immaculate. The Stones is a little sexier, a little bit more kind of raucous and just kind of, you know, Mick Jagger wants to do you. And Paul McCartney.
You get a lot of hate mail.
There's a little bit more like, I want to say that I'm the kind of person who likes the kind of rougher thing.
Mm-hmm.
I like the thing that's a little naughtier
mm-hmm.
versus I like the thing that's a little more. And Madonna and Cyndi Lauper is actually a bad example
it. That's an interesting one, though.
I think it's popular versus unpopular. You know, if you're a Madonna person, you are identifying with the thing that everyone likes. With Madonna, especially in the beginning, it was very much like, this is a thing that is extraordinarily popular and maybe big with popular people. And Cyndi Lauper is much more very openly embracing being a misfit.
Yeah. And I'm hearkening back to the mid-80s when this was all
right.
a thing. But, you know, for me, that's much more about sort of packaged rebellion
mm-hmm.
versus actually being kind of subversive.
Right.
For me, Madonna was packaged rebellion. Madonna mm-hmm. was much more, clearly that was the marketing plan. Whereas for me, Cyndi Lauper was more legitimately subversive in the sense that she was more obviously a kind of weirdo
right.
in a great way, in a way that I loved. And so I responded differently for that reason.
But a lot of these classic pop culture dichotomies don't break down in terms of mainstream versus alternative. Ginger versus Marianne, for example.
Yeah, well, that's another dirty versus clean, though. That's another tougher person versus nicer person.
Well, and coming back to how you identify yourself and what your own preferences are, what your own stated preferences are, Gale versus Peeta in the Hunger Games. It's a little bit of strong. They're both strong, but it's a little bit of strong versus sensitive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also a little bit of sex one versus the other one, which is actually some of what these come down to. And that's a little what Ginger is, too. Some of these are just more kind of conventionally overtly sexy thing versus approachable,
sexy,
sweeter
sexy
thing.
Versus sturdy.
To me, in the books, Gale is more kind of aggressively like, I want to date you. I want to be your boyfriend. Whether or not that's exactly being said that way, to me, it's a more kind of, it's a slightly baser reaction.
Right.
She's more attracted to him.
Right.
Whereas Peeta is a more caring, loving, as I've been known to make the argument in the past, he has the kind of role that traditionally is given to women and girls in movies. Mm-hmm. He's much more nurturing. He talks sense to her when she's, losing her head. He bakes.
Right.
You know? It's the overtly sexy one versus the other one. What do you think, Petra?
These are more interesting to me, not in defining what the dichotomies are, although I'm glad I'm waiting for a taxonomy here. The only taxonomy I could come up with was there are people that make these distinctions and people that don't.
That's right. You can divide the world into two kinds of people.
I keep referencing BuzzFeed, but this goes back to these kinds of quizzes that you take that tell you what...
Which new kid on the block
are
you?
And then that particular new kid has some transitive properties that then apply to you. You know, these dichotomies are always more about who you think you are.
Right.
And by the way, Madonna versus Cyndi Lauper was a big deal as a kid, and I was smirking when you were saying all that stuff about Cyndi being real rebellion and real, because I was a Cyndi Lauper girl.
Absolutely.
Although because I grew up in D.C. in the early 80s, it was actually Janet Jackson versus Lisa Lisa. Somewhere in the depths of my mother's photo album collection, there's a picture of me and my best friend at Halloween, and I'm dressed as Madame de Pompadour, and she's Lisa Lisa. So that's a dichotomy. I don't know what it says about anything.
That is a dichotomy. That is. One of the things I wanted to ask you guys is about this idea of dichotomies that are kind of accessible to lots of people, like Star Wars and Star Trek, which I think we've agreed is partly phony, but thought of as existing.
You're going to get fought on that, but not
well,
by me.
Partly. I'm saying partly. I'm not saying entirely. I'm saying there are many people for whom that's not a divide. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. But in addition to those, there are also ones that only matter to a very, very small group of people. And they don't have to be balanced in order to be dichotomies, right? It doesn't have to be 50-50. Like I was thinking, if you watched What Not to Wear, there are people who liked the first guy they had, who did like the first season, whose name is Wayne. And there are people who like Wayne, but then they brought on Clinton Kelly and he did the vast majority of the episodes. I think you would find, my guess is statistically, the vast majority of those people are Clinton people because he did so many more episodes and because I just think he was better liked.
I'm more of a Dunkelman man than a Seacrest man.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying there are certain ones that are accessible to popular entertainment in general. Right. And then there are these ones where you have to find the exact right person and then they will have really, really strong feelings as to this tiny little thing.
I'm probably alone in this room and having very strong feelings in the classic Trapper John versus BJ Honeycutt.
Oh, do you?
I seem to recall you having strong opinions.
Trapper John is a snide, swaggering jock.
I agree with that.
And BJ is a sensitive guy with great teeth who's easy on the eyes. So right there, boom, done. He's also funnier. He's more given to wordplay.
He's more given to wordplay.
Than Trapper John.
I think he's a better foil.
Yes,
I think
he's
less the same guy. Mm-hmm. Like Trapper John to me is two Hawkeyes, whereas BJ is like a family man and has a gentler sense of humor.
Indeed, I've been talking to a lot of people who come down in the Batman versus Superman divide, pro Batman because I've been writing a book. And if you push even a little bit on their here's why I like Batman, not Superman, it just all falls apart because they're like, well, Batman's like, you and me. I could be Batman. The guy who told me this, I quote him in the book, as he was telling me this, we were at a diner, he was dipping his French fry into a chocolate shake.
That's delicious.
And
shut
said
up.
To me, you and I could be Batman. And I was like, let's stipulate no. Also, Batman doesn't have a superpower. Yes, he does. Wealth. wealth, has a crazy superpower, incredible magic wealth that just makes him able to do anything. And this idea of relatability, this myth of relatability, at one time, this is what separated Marvel versus DC. Marvel characters were relatable, DC characters were icons.
Right.
This today is a distinction without a difference because so many editors, writers, artists keep going back and forth between the two because originally the DC Comics characters were created for kids. The Marvel characters that we know of today and think of as heroes were created for adolescents. They were different. Now there's so much back and forth and the audience is kind of homogenized that it's all the same back and forth. And yet there are Marvel fanboys and yet there are people who will say DC is good. And it's a poisonous, pointless discussion that leads nowhere, and it's just about online anger.
There are certain ones that it just shocks me that they exist, like the whole like Apple versus PC thing still being a thing.
Like, when I was in junior high, there was this rift in the computer science class between Apple people and Commodore people, which tells you how old I am. And also how technologically behind my school was. I'm not that old.
Well, come on, people will never stop needing to feel like they're right and they're better.
That's true.
Garfield versus Heathcliff.
Garfield.
Discuss.
Garfield.
Where does Top Cat fit into this?
Why Garfield over Heathcliff?
Because I never watched Heathcliff.
Yeah. I was totally into Garfield.
I actually was really into Garfield when I was a kid. I can remember having the first couple of books and laughing hysterically at them.
What is the appeal of Garfield?
The thing is, you can't talk about it now because, I mean, Garfield... Jim Davis, I think, is even on record as having said that he engineered Garfield to be as inoffensive and as broadly appealing as possible. Yeah. So you admit to liking Garfield, you're basically saying that your brain is full of oatmeal. I don't know.
Well, that you're into a very mass-produced thing.
I don't know. You'd have to ask me when I was eight.
You'd have to ask me when I was eight. I thought it was very funny that he was so cranky and had this terrible relationship with his parental figure, and running jokes like lasagna are hilarious when you're eight. They are funny.
There are a lot of these dichotomies that just go away. The Mad TV versus SNL.
Well, yeah, sometimes one party wins.
Exactly.
And ER versus Chicago Hope.
ER versus Chicago Hope, right? Exactly. Dallas versus Dynasty was a thing at one point.
That was a city versus country kind of thing.
What do you mean?
Well, Dallas is a country show in its way. Mm-hmm. Dallas was a glam country show. And Dynasty was a Beverly Hills.
Sure.
You know, Dynasty.
Technically Denver.
Technically Denver. I associate that with a kind of a cowboy sensibility versus an LA sensibility.
Sure.
is what I'm saying. And I think you can find elements of that kind of dichotomy actually in lots of forms. I have often been known to say that you have in Broadway musicals, your city musicals and your country musicals. Mm-hmm. Your city musicals like West Side Story and Singing in the Rain is like that. And
On the Town.
And On the Town and ones like that. And then you have Oklahoma and Carousel and, you know, like Lil Abner and
State Fair.
State Fair. There's a whole world of kind of country fair-based, farm-based shows. And mm-hmm. I think you get that same. It's like Dynasty is Singing in the Rain and Dallas is Oklahoma.
Okay.
Having bad high school drama club flashbacks now.
How do you like it?
Paula Tompkins has a very famous bit, Cake versus pie. Where do we come down? Cake versus pie?
Both.
Depends on the pie.
I was going to say, if it's a fruit pie, pie. Mm-hmm. If it's a cream pie, cake.
Mm. Wow. I would almost go the opposite way.
Fruit pies are great.
Any hint of healthiness.
Cream pies are, you might as well just eat whipped cream out of a bowl.
And I'll do that too.
I was just going to say, I'm in.
You're welcome to do that.
I live
that,
my life mit Schlag, you know?
You're welcome.
Also,
you're welcome to do that, but I'd rather have cake.
This is important, and I have had heated arguments about this. I won't have another one because I've grown since then, but creamy versus chunky.
Peanut butter?
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Super chunk.
Super chunk.
Gross and gross. Wrong. What? Why do you hate your soft palate? What did it ever do to you?
I chew.
Crunchy, yeah.
I was going to say, I have teeth,
you're
Grandpa.
You're going to get it ripped up.
You're talking to somebody who puts potato chips in her tuna sandwiches to make them crunchy.
And ripping up your palate, man, I eat crunch berries. I got a palate of steel.
All right. You're wrong. And right, something hurt you in your chest.
Yes, lack of access to crunchy peanut butter hurt me in my childhood.
The grossest thing. You can't spread it. You can't spread it on bread. It kind of rips up the bread.
That is not true. Okay. Creamy peanut
butter.
It
depends on the bread.
Creamy peanut butter is slimy. It might as well be whipped.
It's not called slimy peanut butter. It's called creamy peanut butter. Words have meanings.
I'm just sitting here, both of these things, I'm just thinking delicious. I mean, love them both.
Stephen's like, oh, peanut butter.
I would just eat it out of the jar.
Mm.
Creamy peanut butter is an abomination before the Lord. Like sweet pickles.
Whipped peanut butter is an abomination before the Lord because you are paying more for air. Doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? Creamy is
the same thing as whipped.
It is the porridge that Goldilocks chose. It is perfect, and there's nothing else wrong.
I could talk about food all day.
All right. Pope Urban VI or Pope Clement VII?
Neither. Pope Alexander V. He had a better tomb.
All right. She comes down differently on the papal schism.
Wow.
Of 1378.
Wow.
This has taken a turn.
Mercy's sake, this has taken a turn. I think it's safe to say that that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Because every week I have to recommend a different offshoot of Taylor Swift, I did come across today, the day we are taping this Tuesday, a version of Taylor Swift's Shake It Off at 1/5 speed.
Oh, I heard of this.
And it sounds as if you took some druids and put them in the galley of a great ship. there's this chanting quality and this clanking quality that's very hypnotic. So I have to recommend that. In general, this is now the time of year where I go from writing about new records to pondering all the records that I didn't get around to. So the record that I kind of keep coming back to, even though I'm supposed to be listening to stuff I haven't already heard, is this new record by Damien Rice called My Favorite Faded Fantasy. Talk about people who took long gaps before new records. Irish singer-songwriter took 8 years. It was pretty widely believed that he might never do another record because he just didn't care that much. But this record's beautiful, especially in its second half. Actually, let's hear just a little bit of the song Color Me In. Yeah, so Damien Rice, Color Me In from My Favorite Faded Fantasy. Just a singer-songwriter I'm glad to have back.
Wonderful. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
The first thing I'm going to discuss, the epiphenomenon surrounding a little video called Too Many Cooks. Let's leave the actual video itself alone. But let's talk about the epiphenomena. Now, I'm not going to ask Jessica to play a clip because it is a potent earworm.
Yes,
it is the Shai Hulud of earworms. It is the Shia LaBeouf of earworms. It's a really obnoxious earworm, is what I'm saying. So we're not going to play it, but just let me take you back to the timeline. 9:55 p.m. last Thursday, I get a tweet from a guy named Eamon Hamilton in Australia saying, "Hey, have you seen this?" I favored it because I haven't, so I figure I'll just wait to see it when I have some time. In the ensuing hour, my timeline fills up with everybody tweeting and retweeting and discussing, including Paul F. Tompkins, who says, "You really should watch this." I watch it. At precisely 11:15, I tweeted out saying, join my thin and reedy voice to the chorus of people telling you need to watch this video. And then I swivel in my chair, and I tent my fingers, and I say to myself, "Now we play the waiting game, waiting for the backlash to hit." Mm-hmm. Wait, because we have discussed how these kind of things are just collapsing in time, how long it takes for people to get completely sick of a thing. At 12:12 a.m., that's 2 hours and some 20 minutes later, the first tweet saying, "I have seen this, stop tweeting at me. God, stop it." That was Miss Madeleine Albright. No, it wasn't. But that's the shelf life of this thing, right? People. 2 hours and 20 minutes. It's amazing to me. That's not necessarily making me happy, but I found it fascinating. The real thing that's making me happy is two things from Steve Coogan. Not going to be new to anybody who listens to this podcast, but Alan Partridge is a film that was released as Alan Partridge Alpha Papa in the UK. Here it's just called Alan Partridge. His character that he's been playing for years figures largely in a siege of his radio station. It's hilariously funny. And also The Trip to Italy, which is a sequel to The Trip that he did with Rob Brydon. It follows him and Rob Brydon as they go through the countryside of Italy, eating food and being funny. That's great. So that's The Trip to Italy and Alan Partridge, both Stephen Coogan double feature.
Fantastic. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Petra Mayer, what is making you happy this week?
Oh, lots of things. I guess you can all figure out at this point that one of the things that's making me happy is that the Doctor Who season finale didn't suck.
Yep.
It is sort of traditional for them to be atrocious. And this one was not atrocious, and I am heaving a huge sigh of relief as opposed to
Raves Petromare.
Heaving other things. What I really wanted to talk about was this weekend I got to go to the World Fantasy Convention because it was over in Crystal City, and so all I had to do was drive over there and sit in the hotel bar all day instead of having to buy a plane ticket and a badge.
Yeah.
And it was great because I got to sit there, you know, all day talking to authors and book people, and I know you guys have heard me rave about Garth Nix's Old Kingdom series on this
you
podcast before, and guess who was there at a party? I might have gone up to him at this party and gone, "Oh my God, I love your books. I've made everybody in my office read them." And then realized
I did.
And realized, you know, I'd shot myself in the foot professionally and could no longer approach him in any reasonable manner. But one of the things I loved about World Fantasy, apart from all the famous people that were there, was the opportunity for book discovery. One of the authors that kept coming up over and over and over again was Dorothy Dunnett, who is a Scottish author of historical novels. She started writing in the early 60s, a series called the Lymond Chronicles, and they're about sort of the adventures of an English nobleman across Renaissance Europe. And they appear to have been essentially the Velvet Underground of novels, and that everybody I admire who's working today read them and was influenced. And I've never read them. So I'm super excited. I went to the Montgomery County Public Library site and I ordered up the first two books in the series, and I am going to completely blow my mind reading these from now through the new year. Nice. Not read anything I need to read for work or anything else important like that. So I'm incredibly excited about discovering a vast new mine of books to read. I'm so excited.
Nice. Wonderful. Thank you, Petra Mayer. Well, what is making me happy this week? I don't have one big thing. I have a couple of little things, as sometimes happens. One of the things that made me happy this week is a very fine episode they had last Thursday of The Big Bang Theory, a show that not everybody likes, but I like a whole lot. One of the things that I enjoyed about that episode is that there's been kind of a long arc to some changes in the way that Sheldon in particular sees the world, and some different things that he has tried and some different things that he has learned about himself, and the way that they have kind of slow played that story so that a little happens at a time, and they have been really, really patient at rolling that out over the entire time that show has been on. And I have found it actually quite satisfying as a storyline to see kind of how things are changing for him, and I think that's just been a very interesting thing to watch. But the probably most unexpected thing to make me very, very happy this week, I did write about on the blog, and that is that on Saturday night I was happily watching the Hallmark Christmas movie The Nine Lives of Christmas, which had the description: a confirmed bachelor. I don't think they...
I don't think that word means what you think it means.
I'm not sure they knew how that phrase is typically used. A confirmed bachelor adopts a cat. That basically was the opener. Yeah. And then I saw that the bachelor was being played by Brandon Routh of Superman Returns.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is good. I'll watch this.
And so, this is good. Two thoughts that I didn't have.
This seems great. I'll watch this. So I'm peacefully sitting at home, and I had done a lot of work stuff on Friday and Saturday, so I was kind of conked out on my couch watching The Nine Lives of Christmas. And I was tweeting about it, and all of a sudden I get this tweet that says, "I am looking at Twitter right now, NPR Monkey C, and I am worried about you. This is an intervention. Do not watch cat adopting movies." And it was from Shonda Rhimes. The fine and wonderful showrunner, Shonda Rhimes, who was looking out for me and who did not feel that I should be watching cat adopting
did
movies.
Did not feel you were well served.
Did not feel I was well served by the cat adopting movie. And it really made me laugh. Like, this is what she did with Twitter that day. Like, this is how she chose to reach out on Twitter that day. And it really made me laugh. And I thought it was really funny. And I have been telling this story, and I apologize sort of for telling it again, but not really.
And yet you kept watching because your addiction is stronger than you.
Oh, I kept watching because it was a really good one, actually. Uh-huh. If you're going to try to get into a Hallmark movie, look for The Nine Lives of Christmas. That is an exceptionally good example of this genre. It's actually quite charming.
You've just restated what I just said.
Dude, I have no shame. There is no shame in my Hallmark game. Anyway, that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. Instagram, and you can follow Petra at Petramatic, P-E-T-R-A-M-A-T-I-C. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, that's R-E-E-D-Y, and our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L Migaki, M-I-G-A-K-I. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts worth checking out, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. We all have an instinct, a homing signal, and even when we try to ignore it, it drives us back to the place where everything got started. That's a Snap story, stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. Find it on iTunes under Podcasts.